Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How are you? Are you all right? First of all, let me say that Bonnie Raitt is here. Yeah, Bonnie Raitt, the guitarist, amazing slide guitarist, singer, songwriter, just released her 18th studio record. She's got 10 Grammys and a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Yeah, that one, that Bonnie Raitt. Her new album is called Just Like That. There's a couple of beauties on there. Just great. So excited to talk to her. And by the way, she tuned my guitar so I could try to play slide, which I will at the end of this broadcast. Just saying. By the way, I went to the 50th anniversary party of the Comedy Store last week, and I got jolted. And there was something from that. I can't explain it. Let me try to in a minute. Let me do this first. Tarrytown, New York, at the Tarrytown Music Hall. I'll be there this Thursday, April 14th. I'll be in Providence, Rhode Island, at the Columbus Theater, Friday, April 15th, this Friday. I'll be in Boston at the Wilbur for two shows, April 16th. That's this Saturday. In Portland, Maine, at the State Theater, Sunday, April 17th. And then I'm flying to Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. I'll be there Friday, April 22nd. I've got some shows coming up in Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago, Minneapolis, North Carolina. There's D.C. There's a lot more coming up. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for ticket links and other info on that, on the This May Be the Last Time tour. So, yeah, 50th anniversary of the Comedy Store. Now, look, a lot of you know my history. God knows I talk about it enough. A lot of you know that I was a doorman there back when I was like 22 years old. After I graduated college, I came out here, became a doorman at the Comedy Store. And like right when I walked into that place, I knew that my DNA, there was something genetic about the way I interfaced with that building and whatever it meant. I'd call it mystical. Why not? It was then, but I was psychotic from cocaine use. But it was a mystical connection. Always has been. I was there less than a year, and it never left me, and I never left it, and it knows that I was there, and it knows when I'm there, and it knows when I'm coming. I'm not talking about people. I'm talking about the building, whatever it is, the organic structure. I'm just saying I'm connected to the place, and I can't quite explain it. Now, I was a door guy there, and the guys I would see on stage, a lot of them you would never hear of. You never heard of, right? But I was a sort of boundaryless, poorly parented, untethered soul at 22. Had no real clear sense of self. All I knew was I wanted to be a comic. I knew I was kind of pissed off. I knew I was pretty intense. But other than that, I didn't know much. And I was kind of wandering emotionally, spiritually, physically. And I ended up at that place. And Mitzi Shore was the kind of... I hate to say that she was a maternal figure. She definitely was a matriarch. I'm not sure she had my best interest in mind, nor did the place, but it was a place to fight it out, that's for sure. But when I was there, I took to it, and I lived in that house behind the place, and many of you know those stories, and I used to go down to the store during the day and make my coffee and sit and listen to CDs in the original room as my personal stereo. But I just interfaced with that place, and the guys that I would see were guys doing what I wanted to do. All I knew about comedy, and all I still know about comedy to some degree, is that it's a way for people to make sense of things in a funny way and in a compressed way. That you get up there and you take on the world and it runs through you and it comes out funny, it comes out compact, it comes out poetic, comes out lyrical. However you do it, it's up to you, but you are a conduit of everything that comes through you and puts it back out into the world in a different way, a more compact or funny form. People, these guys made sense of things. These women made sense of things. And I sat there working the door, watching the likes of Charles Fleischer, watching the likes of Joey Kamen, watching the likes of Steve Odenkirk, watching the likes of Karen Babbitt, Jan Hart, Karen Haber, Kathy Ladman, Kip Adada, Damon Wayans, Richard Belzer, Johnny Dark, Larry Scarano, Angel Salazar, Andrew Dice Clay, Nancy Redmond, Tamayo Otsuki, Sam Kennison. There were so many, right? You're going, who? Jeff Altman, Jeff Wayne, the guy with the guitar, Rick Wright. Yeah. A bizarre cast of characters from Jackson Purdue. They were all there. Mark Godier. What happened to that guy? Anyway, a lot of people you don't know, and I don't know what happened to them. My point is, these are the guys I was watching when I was running around as head doorman, jacked out of my mind on coke, trying to, you know, be cool, but just being electrified and connected and running from room to watch whoever. And just, you know, I had my attitudes. I had my judgments. I had, you know, I thought some of the guys and some of the women were sad. I didn't know where they were going to go, if it was ever going to work out, or what were they doing up there, or why am I not up there? A lot of the questions. But nonetheless, my entire mindset was just, I was an appendage of that place. I was electrified by it and running around just as this little kind of hyper angry poetic 22-year-old coked up maniac, but I was in it. So now I'm there almost every night now when I'm in town and I'm working, but my feelings about it are different. It took me a long time to shake. I mentioned Carl LeBeau, Steve Kravitz, Steve Pearl, Todd Lemish, Don Barris, Sparky, the guys I worked door with, Mitchell Shane, Jay Pope, Rodney Blackman, Andy Volver, whatever. So I've been kind of dug into the place. And so now comes this 50th anniversary. And I don't know who's going to show up. But I had to go. I wanted to go primarily for the food. I enjoy buffets. No, I wanted to go to see who showed up. And I got there and I'm just running around and it's packed out and there's a lot of people. But all the old timers, all the sort of unknown old timers are there. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know that Joey Kamen has had somebody as excited as I was to see him respond the way I did to seeing him in a long time. I was like, oh my God, Joey Kamen! Joey Kamen! Are you kidding me? Same. Steve Middleman, what? I was just lit. Joey Gaynor, what's going on, man? Barry Sobel, not as excited, but nonetheless, glad you're still alive. This happened, I said this in this tone, Angel Salazar, holy shit. I was lit up, man, and I was running around that place like I worked there as a doorman again. I felt like I needed to keep things going, keep things managed, keep things moving. But I saw all the Bruce Baby Man Baum, who was before my time, but a lot of these cats knew Ross Bennett was there. All of them, great comics, did the job, had the job. Don't know what a lot of them are doing now. Fritz Coleman, the weatherman who was a comic, came up to me, had nice things to say. Many of them had very nice things to say about WTF. Jimmy Walker was there and said that I don't do interviews anymore because I already did it with you. He said he's got new people coming. He says people that come to my shows are old. But every once in a while, it'll be five or six young people, and they'll come up to me and go, we heard you on Mark Maron's show and wanted to, you know, we were curious, and we came to see. He said, that happens every few shows. So certainly what I'm doing here has had an impact, but I don't know that these guys know what kind of impact they had on me. I mean, it was different than a high school reunion because I was so formative. It was such a formative time that year I spent coked out of my brain at that place watching these guys. They're frozen in some sort of amber in my head. I remember them well. I remember all the stuff that they did on stage, but none of the big guys came. Not many of the new big guys came. Jeselnik was there. And it was so funny because I kept running up to him. Like, saying things like, do you want to meet Joey Kamen? Do you want to meet Joey Kamen? Fritz Coleman is here. You want to meet Fritz Coleman? He's cracking up. And Neil Brennan, actually, I saw him and Kevin Christie looking at me laughing. And I'm like, what? And he said, it's really kind of amazing and endearing that you're actually excited to see these guys. I'm like, I am. And he's like, and there's no judgment. There isn't. Even Bill Kennison. Bill Kennison was there. And that's a little weird. You know, Sam was, that was a lot. You know, Sam did not treat me that well, but he did for a while. But he was an electric being, for better or for worse, that Kennison, who really put the fucking screws to my head and blasted my brain out, both for good and bad. But seeing Bill, who, you know, was not, that whole crew was not the greatest bunch. And there's certainly reasons I could have for, you know, being uncomfortable. But I was just sort of like, I saw Bill and it just reminded me of Sam. And there's a way that these guys, that weird preacher laugh they both have. And it was kind of like being visited by the ghost. And it was kind of lit me up a little bit. I got to admit, it was very exciting. It was very exciting to see all the old timers that have got lost, you know, in the undertow of stand up. At one point, I saw one of the old guys and I'm like, I know that guy, but I'm not sure I remember his name, but I know him. What the fuck is his name? And I had to go into the hallway to find his picture on the wall from a million years ago so I would know his name and I could be polite. I don't know, man. I guess some part of me still lives at that place, obviously. I'm there all the fucking time. Happy 50th anniversary, Comedy Store. They're bringing hors d'oeuvres around. You know, it's all Jewish themed. It's like latkes and little knishes and little bagels and laxes. And there's little pieces of like little squares of pastrami sandwich with some coleslaw on there. And I wanted to know where the meat was from, where the stuff was from, you know, what caterer it was from. And there was some woman, a young woman with a tray. And I said, so where... She had the tray of the small pastrami sandwich pieces. I said, where's this from? And she just looked at me and she says, it's Jewish. And it was the best thing I heard all night. It's Jewish. I'm like, what? They told me it's Jewish. But what restaurant? What's the caterer? It's Jewish. Very exciting. It was Jewish, apparently. So look. Talking to Bonnie Raitt was exciting because she's a great, great guitar player and a great singer, great songwriter. It was just a thrill. And it's like I got some of her old records. It's so funny. This is the other thing I want to tell you. What I've noticed, look, I don't consider myself trendy, but like this vinyl craze, the buying vinyl thing, I've been doing that for a while. Like I started buying records again. I think like a week or two after I started, everyone started buying them. I kind of started the vinyl thing, I'm pretty sure. Not positive, but it's my feeling. Like no one was doing it when I started. But what I've learned about vinyl in particular, and not about like sort of like, you know, excited to buy a new record necessarily, but if I go to a record store, if I'm shopping for records somewhere, and I'm there for over a half an hour, almost 80% of the time, while I'm there, somebody who looks exactly like me walks in to look for records. Give or take a color of pant or color of shirt or type of shoe. Just like to the point where they walk in and we look at each other and we're like, I think I invented you. Did I invent you? Are you real? It's one of those things where you realize like, maybe I don't know why I do things. Maybe I am just a puppet. Maybe my desires and my interests aren't my own. Maybe they're being mined and exploited. And somehow or another, I've met the other guy that has exactly my particular tastes. It's an awkward moment. But I did go like, what are you getting? I was able to look at his records and realize that he was not me. And I was the better one. Yeah, that happens. So look, Bonnie Raitt. Amazing. I can't tell you how excited I was to talk to her. Her new album, Just Like That, is available wherever you get music. She's out on tour right now. You can go to BonnieRaitt.com to see all her U.S. tour dates and get links to tickets. And this is me talking to the amazing Bonnie Raitt. You can move it close to you, like, because you talk right into it, you know, like
this
you're singing.
So cool.
Yeah.
Did you have your place in Highland Park, too?
Yeah, I had a garage, but it was a more cluttered garage. This is actually nicer. Like, this one was, you know, I had it redone. This is basically, I had to make this garage into a house so it would be under permit.
For your own shack.
Either that, when I moved here, like, the people who lived here had it made into, like, a room for one of their kids with the bathroom and everything, they didn't do it on permit. So I got tagged right away.
Oh, my God.
So I had to either make it back into a garage or make it into a house. So I made it into a house. Fuck it.
Nice, nice.
Oh, so these, let me just tell you, this relic business, the reason I think it's great is because it's not it's not assembly line. The guy who did this, it's like a work of art. He had to make it like that to those specs of the old.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's wild. I'm not really one for vintage or, like, I got an old Les Paul Jr. that I like, but I don't know, man. I'm not a collector.
I happen to have the same guitar I've had all this time, but.
Well, it's a Strat, right?
Yeah. But I mean, if I lost, I don't want people to come and steal it, but if I had to replace them.
Yeah.
You know, they're making new ones. Yeah, yeah, they sound great.
Some people go crazy. Buying out these guitars, man. It pisses me off.
I don't want to. To each his own, but I'd rather that they donate.
It's like, money. Hey, Bonamassa, leave some of this stuff out there. We all want to get cool gear, but yeah.
Am I close enough?
Yeah, I think you're going to be all right.
Okay.
So look, right out of the gate, the title track of the new record is fucking devastating.
Oh, I hope in a good way.
Yeah, great way. I listened to it twice and cried.
Oh.
I cried twice.
Wow.
And that's, you wrote that.
Yes, I did.
Did you ever think that when you're like writing like Feeling of Falling that you would write that song? That, you know, that you would write just like that?
I have written in a third part. One time I wrote a song called All at Once in the either Longing in Their Hearts or Luck of the Draw from a third person point of view.
Yeah.
And I love singing Angel from Montgomery every night. And,
yeah.
And I've mined my own personal life on so many songs that I've written over the last 20 albums. So I just knew I wanted to write in a third person, but I didn't know what story I was going to do. And then I saw on the evening news that, you know how they do a human interest story?
Yeah, sure.
They had this, you know, we're going to follow a woman as she meets for the first time the man who received her son's heart.
Yeah.
And I went, wow, that's pretty compelling.
Yeah.
And you know, it was very emotional. And then he sits her down on the couch and they're visiting.
Yeah.
And he said, would you like to put your head on my chest?
Yeah.
And hear your son's heart, and I lost it.
Yeah.
So that's when I decided to write a song about it, that.
Like that song, because I'm like, it's weird because I don't, I'm more of a with blues and stuff, I'm more of a riff guy, and in lyrics, I got to really, like, they got to grab me. So I listened to it like three times, and I'm like, you know, I'm like, the first time I listened to it, I'm like, did I miss the beginning of the story? And then I go back, and I listen to it again, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm starting to choke up a little bit.
I'm glad because
it happened twice.
It slayed me. I mean, I only sang it one time, and I could barely get the vocal out because it's really
one take.
I was playing it for the band, and they just played along so beautifully though that was the take.
Yeah. So this is like, it's been a while since you locked into just a band, right?
No. Well, I mean, to play with my
mom on the record.
But we play with each other since the middle, you know, early 90s, guys. And you know, we just had to delay because of COVID. And a couple of years before that, we extended our tour opening for James Taylor for a big arena tour across the States. I said, do you think I'm going to say no to that? So that was a blast.
Yeah.
And then, you know, nobody, I was going to make a record after that, but then COVID happened. So I had to wait for the vaccines to come in.
So you opened for James?
Yeah.
Is that fun?
It was you know, we've known each other. We all came up at the same time, you know, Jackson and James and John Prine and I.
Yeah.
And, you know, James had already had a couple of albums out. And yeah, he came out on my set. I came out on his.
I interviewed him years ago, and I never know what to think of people because I have ideas about what people are like. But like, I didn't know that guy. And then like, you know, when I learned that like he had such a horrendous drug problem early on, I was sort of like, well, I probably get along with that guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, because you get weird ideas about it because like you look at his audience, just he's probably just filled with nice old ladies at this point, right?
But a lot of them are drug addicts.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, well,
he does. He always sells out, and people love him.
Yeah, those songs. That songbook is incredible.
It is,
and he's,
right?
He's just like what he seems like too on stage.
Yeah.
And off, he's the same guy.
Yeah,
I love him.
Yeah, I was amazed. I interviewed Jackson during COVID too. He got COVID, I think, at some point.
He did. Yeah, he did that Love Comes Together benefit that they just did again in March.
Right.
Yeah. New York, or I forget the name of
That's the one you were supposed to do when I was emceeing. That's where I met you, and you got sick.
I wasn't. I've never been able to do that show because
it was the Americana Music.
Americana Music Awards. I got sick.
Right.
Right. I did sound check.
I know you did sound check, and I was excited.
I was excited too.
Angels from Montgomery.
I know. Luckily, I got better in a couple of days, but I was so sorry to miss it.
Wasn't that with John?
Yeah.
Weren't you supposed to do it with John?
Exactly.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
I know. But, you know, it was like a really bad flu. I had to go get it taken care of.
Yeah.
I was shaking.
Yeah, it was like, I'm glad you're okay. So wait, so you and James and Jackson, where'd you grow up? Here?
Combination of New York and L.A., but mostly L.A. When my dad was on Broadway in Pajama Game in 1954 and 55.
Really?
And yeah, he was the big Broadway leading man. He was original Billy Bigelow on Carousel.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you're in the theater.
Yeah, well, the Broadway theater.
Little girl in the theater.
Yeah.
Right? Were you backstage doing that?
I was backstage in Pajama Game. You know, that was the next big hit he had.
Yeah.
And then they let him be in the movie with Doris Day. So we moved out in 56 or 57. And I was here till I was 15. So like, you know, 57 to 65, I was in L.A.
What did you do at 15? Is that when you hit the road?
No, he got another Broadway show, so he was going to be on the road for a year trying it out. And I went away to the Quaker boarding school in Poughkeepsie, New York for the last 2 years
of high
school.
Is that where you learned the blues?
No, I learned them. I like everybody else, I loved the Rolling Stones, and I loved Little Richard, and I loved, you know, Fats Domino and Ray Charles and the Isley Brothers.
Sure.
I always loved Motown and Staxville and soul music always killed me. And to me, I don't see a big difference between the blues and R&B.
No, it comes from there. Cropper just put out a record. Steve.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Someone just gave it to me. I'm sure it's good.
And guess what else?
What?
Roy Cooter and Taj Mahal just made it.
I heard it, dude.
I can't wait to hear it.
I heard it.
You are in the catbird seat, Mark.
Well, no, man.
You get everything early.
A little bit. Because they were pitching Rye. And, you know, I talked to Taj. It was so funny. Years ago, I talked to Taj and Kebmo together.
Yeah, when they were on tour together.
Right. And, you know, the expression on Kebmo's face when Taj just kept talking, it was just sort of like, all the time, man. This is what it's all the time.
The guy, he's like a national treasure. They should just turn the tape on.
With Taj?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I listened to that record. It's all Sonny Terry, Briony McGee songs.
Can't wait.
It's great.
Can't wait.
Because it's raw, man. Like, everyone's doing that raw thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they're just letting those the distortion
stuff. Yeah,
it sounds great. It sounds great. Those are great songs.
Yeah,
I just watched some documentary on the plane of all the old blues guys. It was I don't even know where they shot it. It was kind of a weird thing.
Is it the one in Europe?
Yeah,
American Folk Blues Festival.
Right, were they?
That's the greatest footage that exists on the earth today from 62 to 66. Yeah.
But it's a little weird that they, like, you know, built these porch environments. And
was weird.
It was like...
White people are weird.
They are, but I don't think they knew what they were doing, where it's like, well, they have these amazing blues artists. Let's build a juke joint.
Yeah, I know. It was the 60s, you know.
I watched it. They had it on the airplane for some reason.
Now, that is amazing. You can't get it streaming on the ground.
I know.
You can get it up in the air.
Well, there's just some new service, I think, through Prime that they're doing just music documentaries, and they had that one.
Oh, good.
Because I had an old, like... VHS of it.
That's me too.
Right.
Me too. I don't have it in the new formats, which whatever that is probably going back to.
It's so, like, there's some stuff on there.
Super 8 will be next.
And you got to work with Fred McDowell, right?
Yep. Fred
McDowell,
Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, all those guys. Big Mama Thornton. You know, but man, Mississippi Fred McDowell, so incredible.
What a groove on that slide, though, man. Yeah. It's so haunting, and it's so specific. And you covered one of those tunes.
I did. We were supposed to do it together on my second album. It was Write Me a Few of Your Lines in Kokomo Blues.
Right. Yeah.
I opened for him at the Gaslight and toured with him. I was still in college, and I just loved him and loved the blues.
It's
and
so good.
I said, I'm cheap. I'll open for you. You know, you don't have to pay me anything. Just let me come and, you know, hang with you. And because of my connection with the guy who managed him and rediscovered Son House, and he managed Buddy Guy Junior Wells, I got the, you know, talk about a great position of being. I took a semester off from college just to hang out with those guys.
I can't even imagine it. Like, it was like, it must have been. So, but how do you start? So, you're into Stax and Motown and everything. So, what gets you to the blues? It was interesting listening to the first time to some of this stuff, like your first few records. Because I don't know what you think, but there is a point where, you know, your voice becomes full. You know?
Yeah, No, I was a little shrimp. Right? I couldn't stand the way I sang.
Like, it was probably around Sweet Forgiveness,
right? I was smoking and drinking, trying to get my voice older and, you know, swaggering, like, because I had this little soprano voice, you know? and I was hanging out with all these older blues people, and I just said, man, this is, I am such a wimp. I love folk music, but I got to be authentic, you know? And then by the time Sweet Forgiveness happened, I was kind of 28. You know, you're cooked at 28.
You're cooked, but
10 years on the road.
It was a fullness, though. It wasn't a raspiness. It was just coming from the place where.
Well, thank you. I don't go back and listen to those, but if you hear that and have heard it.
We can hear it. The switch.
I thought I had to wait till I was 40 to like it.
No, you'll like it. So you're doing, where do you start playing the blues? How does that happen?
You know, I grew up, I went to summer camp in the Adirondacks while my dad was on tour in summer stock. And all the counselors were caught up in the folk craze of the late 50s, early 60s, and I idolized my counselors. So that's what we did, was we played folk music.
Like who?
And Joan Baez and Odetta and
Stone
Pete
Ponies?
Seeger. No, that's 10 years later. But
is it?
Yeah. Oh. But, I mean, this was 59, 60, 61 when I was a little kid. I got a guitar for Christmas at 9, and I taught myself to play. And then I heard on Joan Baez's Vanguard label was Blues at Newport 64 and Brownie and Sonny, Mississippi John Hurt, John Lee Hooker, Reverend Gary Davis, John Hammond, Dave Van Ronk. It was killer.
Was that the one with Skip James too? Or no?
Yes, Skip James.
Oh, my God. They found that guy.
Yeah.
And they put him up there. What a haunting thing that was.
Oh, my God. I do one of his tunes in my shows.
Which one?
Devil Got My Woman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love that song.
And John Hammond. I talked to John Hammond.
Isn't he great?
That guy, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves.
I completely agree. He's the reason I got good on blues guitar, was because I was hoping to meet, and I hope he would fall in love with me and run away with me.
Did he? No?
No, he was already married. But we were really good friends.
Because, like, his story, like, when I talk to him, he's not real willing to, you know, to talk. You know, but it's just such an odd, heartbreaking tale that he's estranged from his father, who signed Bob Dylan and everybody else. And then Dylan steals his fucking band early on.
Yes. Yeah,
like, but like his blues, I don't know why or how, but it's so authentic.
It's so authentic. And the guy is like, when the body language, when he's on that stool playing the harmonica and playing a guitar, it was just incredible. I mean, to me, it's like as compelling as James Dean, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I saw him open for the Staples Singers years. I mean, I didn't see him when he was young, but it was just him on that guitar. I saw him? My brother lived in Tucson. I went to college in Tucson.
Cool.
And I went to visit my brother, and the Tucson Blues Society was presenting John Hammond. I'm like, we got to go to that. Can we still get tickets? I swear to God, there was like 20 people there.
Oh, that's a shame.
Well, yeah, but it was in a small room. But he just, and we were all just sort of standing
there. He inhabits
there.
The stuff. And he's been like that since he was a teenager.
Wow.
You know, I mean, people say, how did you get like that being the daughter of a Broadway singer? And I'd go, how did you, you know, I mean, imagine the legacy he grew up with all these guys. But he really soaked it up, man.
He did.
And when I looked at the back of that album.
Yeah, which one?
When I was 14, Blues at Newport 64, on Vanguard, and I saw that he was white, I went, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he mixed it up. Like, he did all kinds. Like, you know, he can do that acoustic blues thing, but then, you know, you listen to Source Point. I love Source Point.
killer.
Don't you?
Yes, I do. Southern Fried, I love.
That's with Duane, right?
Too Many Roads, I love them all.
Too Many Roads, that's with the band. That's early. Yeah, 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 that's great. So you okay? So you're at camp listening to this,
I'm
and you're
at
like,
camp, I got, and I was a
get
folky.
Someone get me a bottleneck slide.
What? And I soaked the label off of a Coracidin bottle because I'd never seen anybody play.
Oh.
I just heard it said bottleneck.
So a glass Coracidin bottle.
So I
bottle?
Used that. That was the closest. My parents didn't drink, and I, that was the closest I could get. And I put it on my middle finger, which actually isn't the right finger.
Right.
But I didn't see anybody till I was already. I'd already learned how to play and taught myself all these Robert Johnson
songs.
So
it's still on your middle finger?
Yeah. Because we used to flip the bird all the time in L.A.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like this.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how you hold the bottle.
Yeah. But you keep it on the original finger. Where do people usually put it? On the pointer?
Well, some people do the third,
pinky.
But the ring finger and the pinky allows you to use your other fingers to play more stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. It works for me.
So what was the first slide stuff that you kind of picked up? Who was the one that first moved you the most? Was it John?
Yeah, but I Robert Johnson, that record came out when I was 15 or 16. But, I mean, Little Red Rooster was badass.
Oh, totally.
You know, that slide playing. And pretty soon,
one of
my
Howlin'
older
Wolf version.
No, the Stones. That was the first time I'd ever heard slide guitar. But then
the
I heard the real guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
When you're 14 or 15, you don't have. I couldn't drive.
Well,
I didn't have any money. I couldn't go buy the. You know, it was either you're going to buy the new Beatles, the new Bob Dylan, the new Stones, or a blues record.
Right.
And it was really hard because you had $4 and that was it.
Yeah, and that's what the Stones did for us, though.
Yeah.
They gave everybody the blues.
Exactly.
Like, it's kind of astounding.
And, you know, even the Beatles cut a bunch of cool R&B songs.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And the whole British invasion, they brought the blues to America.
Chains. What song is that? Chains, my baby's got me. Because the Beatles did that.
Yeah.
I think that's
I don't
R&B
know who
song.
Did the original.
It's great. I love that song.
Yeah.
So that's how you got to it.
But to me, the difference between Ray Charles and old R&B and Lloyd Price and Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, they weren't that different. They're just funky, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can hear all that through all the music. I mean, then at some point you kind of picked up some reggae thread a bit.
Well, we all, I was going to school in Boston. I lived in Cambridge for 6 years.
What school?
I went to Harvard and was majoring in African studies and social relations. And Cambridge was against there was 300 colleges all active against the war.
I lived in Boston,
And then, the Club 47 closed my freshman year, which was a drag. But
what was that?
That Club 47 was this iconic, like the Gaslight, really amazing folk club in Cambridge.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Harder They Come came in and played the Central Square Theater for like 2 years, and I went nuts
for
reggae.
A midnight movie?
Yeah, but it was on prime time. I mean, people wouldn't let it go.
Right, yeah,
so I went nuts for Toots and the Maytals and Bob Marley. And,
yeah.
I mean, the whole record and the movie itself.
Yeah, and did you do a Toots song on this one?
I did a Toots song that I was supposed to cut with him, but he passed away last year.
Of COVID, right?
Yeah.
Terrible.
Well, or they didn't say it was COVID, but it was respiratory, so.
Right.
But I did True Love.
Great
song. It's hard to find on my record in 85, and then we became friends and he invited, I did it on his reggae, a Grammy Award winning duets record called True Love, which he did with everybody.
Yeah.
And then we did another one called Premature.
Uh-huh. Do you still listen to reggae?
I do.
Huh.
And I love Soweto music too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Indestructible beat of Soweto on Earthworks. Get out of here.
Yeah, I listen. I did a short interview with Keith Richards like a week ago, and I asked him the same question.
Yeah,
do you still listen to reggae?
Oh man, got to do it.
Yeah, I listened to some when I was younger, but it never became like a constant. For you, it did.
Well, like soul music, there was a certain era that I really loved. There's a certain era of a Chicago blues, era of soul music that was really more. It's more vintage, what they call it now. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with reggae and African music.
Senegal music.
More, it's a lot of current music is much more dance hall, big bass drum, and all that stuff.
But some of that Senegalese stuff, I mean, you can hear that in Skip James.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Ali
Farka Touré.
Yeah.
And, people always say that must be where John Lee Hooker got it. It was the other way around.
Oh, really?
I mean, there's Arabic, Arabic scale.
It goes back.
The slaves that were brought to the south, to the Delta, came from that western part of Africa.
Yeah.
And the reason why the drum is so significant in South America is because those guys came from the Congo, where the drums are more pervasive.
In the music, yeah. Well, I mean, I listen to Taran. That stuff, there's some young guys doing that.
Yep.
Modu Mokhtar.
Yeah.
He can do that stuff's great.
I got to go to Mali for 3 weeks with the guys that have that Afropop Worldwide, you know, that radio show on PRI. Uh-huh. They organize these travel safari kind of things where you get to go to the towns where the musicians you love are from, and they put on a big party, and you know, you dance and see how nice. Oh man, it was killer.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you're in college in Harvard,
and just playing for a hobby, and I was just playing in my room,
playing slide mostly.
No, playing folk guitar.
Music?
You know, same mix of ballads I did Since I Fell for You, which was a big hit when I was 11.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, James Taylor songs. Yeah. I did an Elton John song. Then I did Robert Johnson and Sippy Wallace. So it was always a similar mix, but I was just playing for myself. And then I met Dick Waterman, and he managed all these legendary blues guys.
In college you met
him.
What was he doing there? Why
he
did
lives
you meet
in Cambridge.
Oh.
Yeah, a friend of mine said, you want to hear Son House on the radio.
Was he the guy that went down and found him?
Yeah.
I saw a documentary about that. Three guys.
Yeah, Nick Pearls, Phil Spiro, and Dick.
And then John Fahey on the other coast went and found Skip James, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But those guys went upstate and they found Son House.
Like, they thought he was down south, and then he was a Pullman porter for 20 years in Rochester, New York.
And then they put out Death Letter, right?
Oh, God.
That album's crazy.
Unbelievable. So I got to meet, my friend called me up and said, do you want to meet Son House?
Yeah.
The guy who managed and rediscovered him is living in Cambridge, so right around the corner from where we were.
Right.
So that changed my life, because that's how I met Fred McDowell and Skip James. And
did they have Skip Pence too? Did they do
Joseph Spence? Spence,
yeah.
I love Joseph Spence.
That stuff's crazy.
Yeah.
Skip Spence is the guy from Moby Grape.
Joe Spence. A record together.
I think they're both dead. But I got a couple of those old records. Like, what are they on, our Hooli or something? Or
yeah, Joseph Spence is killer.
It's crazy.
And Rye covered him a lot, coming in on A Wing and a Prayer.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you meet this guy, and he hooks you up with these, you meet all these old blues dudes. So do you learn? What do you do?
Well, like, I already knew their music, and I loved Son House already, and I loved Fred McDowell already, so I just never thought I would meet them.
Right.
And then I hung out, and, you know, I would get to go to blues festivals with Dick, and then I just took a semester off to hang out with these guys, because I knew they were up in age, and I they weren't going to live forever.
Were you playing with them?
No, I was just hanging out, but my parents said, if you drop out of school for a semester, you're on your own. So I got a regular job. And
At
the American Friends Service Committee.
What's that?
That's a Quaker social action arm, kind of like the Peace Corps of the...
So you're always, like, were you majoring in stuff that you were going to engage your
social activism?
Social activism,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So anyway, I saw a girl playing in a club in Philly where Dick had moved to, and I said, man, I could do this.
What girl?
I don't even remember her name,
really?
But I said, you know, I'd rather be working in this club than working in the day and walking a half hour in a skirt with pantyhose on.
Right.
And I auditioned and I got the gig.
Yeah.
Then I got another gig. And then Dick said, okay, I'm going to put you on a couple of shows with some of my acts.
Yeah.
And, you know, here I am playing with my heroes. And to answer your question, did I learn from them? You know, watching them every night.
Who were you opening for?
John Hammond.
Oh, yeah.
Fred McDowell.
Oh, man.
Then I opened for Cat Stevens and James Taylor.
Those are pretty good guys. They're very different.
Yeah.
But, like, to watch John Hammond, I mean, what tuning do you use?
On open tunings?
Yeah.
Just open E or open A.
Okay.
I mean, open those two, or else I go to G or D.
What did Elmore use, E?
You know, I don't know.
I wonder. I think
he used open E.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That, I call it the dust my broom key,
exactly.
So it has to be Elmore James.
Right, exactly, right? So, but John, like, you know, you're just picking up those riffs, you know? I mean, it's...
By ear, yeah, because I just loved it. I mean, the slide just... It's people.
Slide,
I don't know anybody that doesn't love slide.
Your slide sounds great, and it's specifically you. There's a lot of, like, show offs, you know, but you kind of, like, you do the
Bonnie
Raitt
thing. I got that slow thing. I learned that from Lowell, because I loved Little Feet so much, and I asked Lowell how he got that long sustain on his slide.
Yeah.
And he said, here's this MXR compressor, and that's the trick.
That's it.
You compress the sound and can go.
That was the
forever.
Trick. Yeah.
Yeah. So that got my.
Well, that
got
that,
my attention.
So you're touring with these cats, you know, the old guys and Cat Stevens, who at that time, that must have been huge.
That was just one gig, but it was a big honor. And, you know, I was inexpensive. I carried my own guitar. I did a little blues, a little folk, a little pop, you know.
Yeah. And James. All right. So then when do you come back here?
L.A.,
How long do you hit the road for?
I started playing these clubs, and then somehow there was like a little bidding war. People, I said, like, listen, I'd
for
really
the first
like,
record, for a deal?
Yeah, I got. Okay. I went to Warner Brothers and said, if you let me have complete artistic control, yeah. I'll sign with you, because I loved Ry Cooder, and Randy and James were on there.
Randy.
So I did my first couple of records, and then on the third album, I wanted to work with Little Feat, and I moved to California.
So it was after Little Feat's what, first record?
Second.
The second record?
That's when I met them, what, during Sailing Shoes. And, you know, my friends in Boston were, there was already James Taylor, so yeah. My male singer-songwriter friends weren't going to get a deal because yeah. The record companies were going, oh, we already have James Taylor. We don't need another Boston
right.
folky.
Right.
Meanwhile, I wasn't even looking for a deal, and I get one. So they were happy for me, but there was a little resentment. So I got tired of shoveling snow, so I came back out here.
But you were hanging around with Lowell?
Yeah, Lowell and Little Feat played on my third album, along with Taj and John Hall from Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
And Billy played on a bunch of my records.
Billy who?
Billy Payne, sorry.
Oh, that, yeah, right. From Little Feat.
That, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, Lowell George, like, he's another guy that is underappreciated, I think.
Oh, he's a god in a lot of the music world, though.
Right.
Guitar world.
Yeah. But, like, he died so young.
Yeah, 29.
But they kept going forever. I think they still go.
Yeah, well, funny thing about mortgages and kids, you know, you got to keep paying. But I mean, once you love to do this, you're not going to give up stand up, you know, because what would you do at night?
I know it's hard enough
during COVID. What are you going to do? Talk to your comedy on a Zoom call? I don't think so.
I can't do it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going out right now. I'm doing like a thing that I've never done before. And to me, it's kind of amazing. I'm no opener. I'm just going out and doing 2 hours.
An evening with?
Basically.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, I've done it before, but not confidently. You know, because like sometimes I'm like, I might need a buffer. I might need a
camera. I know. And then you got to take the training wheels off.
Exactly.
Because Jackson started to do it. He loves playing by himself, but he was wondering how it was going to be tonight.
Oh, really?
To do a whole evening with.
Do you do them?
No. But I like sharing the tour with Mavis Staples and Lucinda Williams.
Well,
you know, I like standing in the wings and watching my friends and collaborating, you know.
Yeah, Mavis
so it's
great.
A little bit of
well,
both.
Those two, out of all the women in the world, those two are the best.
Yeah, well, one of them's on the first third of the tour, and then Mavis is on the last two thirds.
How's Lucinda doing?
I think she's great.
She good?
Yeah,
good.
She's good.
All right, good. I've talked to Mavis. She always seems good.
Oh, 83 and pumping it, man.
She's so good. I love talking to her. All right, so you come out here and you're hanging out with Lowell. Now you're hanging out with Randy too, or you just love Randy?
I love Randy. I met him, but he was living on Santa Monica's side. And those of us in Laurel Canyon, it was like this. I mean, I've probably done 6 specials, BBC and documentary on Laurel Canyon
just now,
in the 70s.
In the last 10 years?
I mean, yeah. Well, the last 20. Britain did it first, and then America caught up and said, let's do something about Laurel Canyon in the 70s. But it was,
like,
you know, J.D. Souther and... Well, Crosby and those guys, I think they were already in a higher zip code than
okay.
that.
They already
made a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, at that time, the Eagles were just forming, and
Souther
Tom
was
Waits.
There. Waits.
Jackson.
Didn't Waits sing on one of your albums?
Yeah, he did. And he toured. He was our opening act in 1975. I opened for Jackson on my first national tour in 74.
Yeah.
For my fourth album tour.
Yeah.
Then the next year, I invited Tom, and he rode on our tour bus with us.
Oh.
It was a blast.
Wait, now what version of him was that?
Well, he was still 75. He was like in a string tie and a suit.
A shirt and a hat.
You know, we'd pull into the town, and he would go stay overnight sitting in the lobby writing lyrics in a flop house and kind of the
that was
Skid Row section of town. And then he'd show up for the bus ride to the next city, and he'd had whole bunches of paper full of lyrics, you know.
That was his thing.
Yeah.
And was he just playing piano? He would just go out and play piano?
He played piano, and he had a bassist and a drummer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. That must have been wild to see
him
then.
Oh, he was great.
Because he's sort of one of those guys that kept going out there.
You know, when I'm thinking about it, I think he was solo on that tour.
Hmm.
Must have been solo. Anyway, that was
just on the piano.
I have to check it out.
Well, he's like, as an artist, like to see that guy evolve and to see like that him shed that persona and then go into outer space or wherever he lives.
How about the Ballad of Earl, not Earl Scruggs, Buster Scruggs.
Buster Scruggs, yeah. Oh, he's great in that.
He's really great in it.
He's great. He's a good actor. He's always
good.
He is.
Good. You're a good actor, too.
I appreciate
it. I love Glow.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love that, too. I wish we could have made the last
one. Babes for Days.
Yeah, for sure. So, all right. So,
and you didn't even have to get slapped around on the.
No, not at all. And it was funny. The funniest thing
about that
is
too.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about that was like I knew all these like. You got to sign in the contract whether you're willing to do nudity or not. And I knew all the women were, yeah, they're going to say yes because it's, you know, it's going to be part of the deal at some point. So I'm like, I got to say yes, I guess. And I just had to show my ass. I was okay with it. I did it, though.
That's fantastic.
Out of respect for the ladies.
That's great.
I'm going to show something.
That's, you know, really sweet.
So, all right. When these first few albums, like on the second album, you do a Sippy Wallace song.
Even on the first, I did too.
You did too?
Yeah.
And so you're really kind of like doing a blues thing, right?
Well, some of the record is blues.
No,
sure.
I know. Like it mixes it up.
But I didn't get a band. So for me, it was just acoustic guitar. So I had to play everything alone on my guitar. And sometimes I had a bass player. And then after I got Freebo, we were
Is Freebo? Is he still around?
Yeah, he's still around. He's a solo artist now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he's like on all your records. He's on a lot of them.
He was on the 70s, yeah.
Yeah. But like, were you also playing on other people's records? Like, was he part of that community?
I sang on Dixie Chicken with Little Feet. And I did eventually through the mid-70s, you know, John Prine and myself and Jackson and James, we all sang on each other's records.
That Dixie Chicken groove is one of the great grooves.
New Orleans,
deep,
man.
Deep groove. It's a great song.
Lowell turned everybody, Little Feet turned us on to New Orleans.
That?
I mean, everybody heard... Working in a coal mine and, you know, mother-in-law and all that stuff. I mean, there's iconic Fats Domino records.
Yeah.
But Little Feet revived a lot, turned people onto the Meters.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but what was Laurel Canyon when you were there? Who was hanging around? It wasn't just J.D. Souther, was it?
Well, no, it was Little Feet and me and...
Zappa?
Ned Doheny. Zappa, but he didn't hang. He wasn't a partier.
Right. Right.
And, you know, the Eagles kind of soon, and Linda went out to Malibu because they were banking in the coin at that point. So,
but is that after the Stone Ponies?
Yeah. Linda was the biggest rock star in the country.
At that time.
Yeah.
Because I got those Stone Pony records. They're kind of interesting.
That was really early, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, she's the best thing about those records.
Yeah. She's a great singer. Great singer.
How's she doing?
She's good.
Oh,
she's
good.
She's good. Progressing kind of slow, that her condition or Parkinson's. So
yeah.
She's still good. I see her a few times a year.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So that was her time. That was when she was like everywhere. I kind of remember that.
Oh, man. That documentary about her is so fantastic.
Like, what is it? 70?
James Keach did it.
74, 73? What are we talking? When you were out there.
Oh, when.
Laurel Canyon.
Oh, I was there 73 till about. I don't know. I moved up north in 1990. I started hanging out up north.
Okay. So when did, so that was a party scene, obviously. But the Eagles, that was such a huge thing. So you were around when they broke?
I was on the road like 10 months of the year, and I made seven albums in 6 years. So one of those two things.
So when the Eagles were huge, that was like a little later, right? 75, 76?
Yeah.
It's weird that it's funny, like a lot of people come back into fashion, but for some reason the Eagles don't. And I don't know why.
Think they never went out of fashion. Everybody
Maybe.
Loves their stuff.
Well, I mean, it's like
Sly Stone. Did you ever get tired of Sly and the Family Stone?
I know, but there are certain bands that the hipsters like.
I don't have my finger on the pulse of who's.
Yeah, but the Eagles, when you really look at their songbook, it's insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah. I mean, there's bands like U2 and the Police and the Eagles and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and then there's James and Jackson that just keep doing great records for decades and decades and decades. So.
Solid.
And Randy, our friend.
Randy.
Randy, one of the greatest artists of all time. Underrated.
So funny, too.
Needs to be. I mean, of course, he does great soundtracks, too. But, you know, there's more to Randy than Short People, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had him in here. I talked to him for a couple hours once.
Isn't he the greatest?
I love him. I love him. I reached out to his agent or somebody afterwards. I said, look, if he's ever lonely or needs someone to talk to, like, it's just like, I'm around.
He's one of the funniest human beings on the planet.
And you covered Guilty on
Taking My Time.
That's one of the best songs in the world.
It is a great song. Great song.
What is that? And if you're a druggie, the understanding of that song is so profound.
Was totally in my wheelhouse at that time. And I did another one that was about kind of like, I need a drink, you know, about that dark night of the soul kind of night called The Glow.
Oh,
another
yeah.
great drinking song.
Was that the name? That was the record, right?
Yeah.
Well, guilty that way. It takes a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend that I'm somebody else. It's like, oh my God. It's like, you know, you see, if you use it, that you just feel seen, and it's like, it's not great, right?
Yeah.
So when did you hit the wall?
I just got heavy and wanted to lose some weight because I was going to work with Prince in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And I went, you know, I got some trouble with my knee, so I had to stop running. I had a heartbreak of my relationship end. And somewhere in there, just before my tour opening for Stevie Ray Vaughan, Warner Brothers dumped me and T-Bone Burnett, Van Morrison, and Arlo Guthrie because we weren't bringing in the big coin.
Wow.
So I had to cancel the tour, put everybody out of work.
Van Morrison?
Yeah. Well, you know, the big corporate people took over the little record companies.
Yeah.
You know, there was a consolidation in the 80s.
Right.
So Warner's was no longer just Warner Brothers with James and Ryan and Randy, where they make their money from Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, and then they subsidized Little Feat and me.
Right.
Or Alan Toussaint and the Meters. We were all on there, and everybody loved the fact that we didn't have to crank out hit records.
Right.
We were album artists.
Yeah.
In for the long haul.
Right.
And then the corporations came, and Warner, Elektra, Atlantic were consolidated. And the bean counters were looking at who had renegotiated their contract but wasn't bringing it in and worth it. And that was me and Van and some other people.
Huh.
So I was having a rough time in the middle 80s. And Prince called up and said, let's do some stuff together. I'll put you on Paisley Park.
Wow, Prince.
And I said, you know what? If we make a video together, I better drop some weight. So that's when I quit drinking, was to lose weight. And I just loved it. I just went right to the hanging out with a bunch of musicians that had gotten sober. I kept hearing these stories. They looked better. They felt better.
Well,
they played better.
So you didn't have some massive bottom?
No.
No.
I had a fat bottom. That was my... I mean, you know, I chunked up in the stuff you could get away with before.
Yeah.
You know, tequila and not exercising does not sit well on you. And I was heartbroken and pissed off about being dropped. And my heart was broken, and I was just trying to numb it out.
Was that after your marriage?
No, I didn't get married till later.
Oh, so that's somebody else.
So in the mid-80s, and the whole lurch to the right of the, you know, the country went on, and music had no place for roots artists like myself.
So,
and by the end of the decade, Tracy Chapman had a hit, Edie Brickell, Robert Cray, the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Yeah, Fabulous
and
Thunderbirds.
And college radio was rocking.
Yeah.
VH1.
Blasters.
VH1 started to play adults.
Yeah.
And I said, man, let's get a new record label and put out a record.
And what happened with Prince?
Nick of Time.
Yeah.
Well, it was a scheduling thing. By the time we got our schedules lined up, he had already recorded the songs in the wrong key with lyrics that didn't really fit me.
Yeah.
So we were going to meet together again in a few months, and I canceled my summer tour so I could work with him in July, and he forgot to call me and say he'd extended his European tour.
Oh, so that was like added more to the fire.
Yeah, it was not great.
But you were going to be on his label, and that just...
I was going to maybe. I said, if we can meet, we were going to meet in the middle. I said, I don't want to make a Prince record, and you don't want to make a Bonnie Raitt record.
So. Right, so...
So I was looking forward to it, but I'll tell you what I got out of it. Lost weight, got sober, and I've been sober 35 years, so...
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming up on, I guess this is, 23, something. Good for,
I remember that, too. and we'll be able to remember a lot of it.
So Stevie Ray, was he sober when you were working with him?
When Stevie and I we toured together in 86 in the summer, and he got sober right after, and I got sober not long after he did.
Wow.
So there was a string of us in our late 30s, and he was younger than us.
He got way out there, though.
But he was playing. I didn't like playing messed up, and he could play pretty high.
Yeah.
And he's a monster. And you know what? Then he came out of, he was still in rehab, and he came to watch our show in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And he was just freshly sober.
Yeah.
And I asked him if he wanted to sit in, and he was a little nervous.
Yeah.
But he just killed it.
Really?
And so that's my last excuse. I said, okay, that's it.
If he can do that sober.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
I must have been wild to see him live. I can't even imagine.
Oh, well, there's lots of footage of him.
No, I know. But,
in my life, I missed seeing Hendrix live. But I, you know, see him on every piece of footage I can find.
Sure.
And record, but Stevie Ray was, in my lifetime, Lowell and Stevie Ray and Jimi Hendrix, greatest.
Sure. Yeah. I like his brother. I like the way Jimmy plays. Like Jimmy.
I love Jimmy Vaughan. We did a lot of touring together, and we've done a couple of really cute duets together.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he sounds like him.
Yeah.
You know
what I
mean?
He's a real original.
Yeah. So, all right, so after all this, that's when Nick of Time happens?
Yeah.
Ninth record or so? 10th record?
Was it the 9th? No, 10th.
10th record.
Yeah, new record label.
You've been at it a long time.
Yep. And it was already a good, you know, I met Don Was. We had a great time. I had a new lease with a new record label that had something to prove. We made a cheap record.
What is it about Was? I've talked to him, you know, and I like him.
Isn't he great?
He is. He's like a strange little savant of some kind of musical, like, I don't know what it is. Because, like, I love that. Did you listen to that Stones Blue and Lonesome record?
Yeah.
That's crazy, that record.
I know.
I mean, I can't believe that record.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
And that's Don. Like, yeah, what is it about him?
Well, I mean, it's them, you know what
I
mean?
No, I know, but like, because you've worked with a lot of
but
producers.
But he just helps, yeah, but I produce myself. Most of the records, I'm picking the songs and,
right.
You know, involved in the mix and how everything sounds. It's not like I'm getting produced by somebody else.
Ever?
But no, I've never had somebody like step. It was always like a collaboration.
Okay, so good.
There was one time when, on my fourth album, where my producer put strings and horns on something after I left, and then he apologized later. It was really, anyway, but Don. Other than that, Don is just a vibe guy, man. He's really smart, really knows tons about a lot of different kinds of music, but he has the ability to distill what's great about an artist and help them get out of their own way.
Interesting.
So he brings the essence of them out and is just a soft-spoken, mellow, great, non-egotistical guy, but really a good musician, really insightful. And, you know, that there's very few people with the vibe of Don Was.
So, like, he doesn't, you don't feel that he's guiding you, or you don't feel that he sees?
No, he's just another guy that's, you know, saying, hey, you may want to think of, you know, like.
Does it happen on the board?
In the studio, well, that's engineer, right?
Right, but so does Don talk to you about, like, you know, like a take, or like, you know, maybe
No, I mean,
this?
You just go, it's a collaboration.
Interesting.
You go, I think we got it. What do you think? I'll do it one more just for safety. You know, at that point, you're just partners. You know?
Yeah. And then so...
He's somebody with a perspective that's not in the room playing, so you just want one more opinion.
Right.
But you got to have somebody you really respect.
So, Nick of Time, like, you were ready, weren't you?
I was ready, yeah. And I, you know, Hal Wilner got Don and I together to do this song for this Disney tribute album.
I love that album. Didn't Tom Waits and Los Lobos did it too, right?
Yeah, Whistle While You Work.
Yeah, that was Tom, right?
Yeah.
And I think Los Lobos did the Monkey song. Ooh, I want to be just like you.
Unbelievable.
It's a great record. Poor Hal passed away.
I know.
Did you guys stay friends?
Hadn't seen him in a long time, but I used to go on Letterman and see Sheila all the time.
Oh, is that his wife?
Yeah, Sheila Rogers was the booking person for Dave.
Okay.
For years and years.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so I would see Hal, but Hal and I mean, I love those tribute records he did, and I loved him, and he loved NRBQ like I did.
Uh-huh. So what came out of you and Hal? What came, that's how you met Don? Or?
Yeah, he said, how'd you like to do this song from Dumbo with Was Not Was? And I love Was Not Was. And Don was surprised I was a fan of his.
Yeah.
And I was completely surprised that he knew about me.
Yeah.
Because it's like a total different generation.
Yeah. Well, that's nice.
Yeah,
it all
so
worked
we
out.
Hit it off. And I said, hey, man, I loved working with you. Would you ever consider working in studio together?
Yeah.
Like maybe you could produce my next record. And he said, let's make a record that's just, if you can sing the song on just you and a guitar, you and a piano, and make it sound like one of your songs, like nobody else could do this but you. Let's start with that, strip down and add the pieces we need.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the reasons. I mean, Nick of Time musically is not that different than my other records, but it just was a very, I was a different person a couple years sober, and just the vibe in the room. Great engineer, Ed Cherney, we lost last year. Mm. And he had done Get Rhythm with Ry Cooder and El Rayo X with David Lindley's band.
Yeah.
And I went, Don, I got to tell you about this guy, Ed Cherney. I don't know him, but let's get him.
Yeah.
So that was the Mighty Trio.
Together.
And my longtime rhythm section, Ricky Fattar and Hutch Hutchinson. And Don brought some guys. We had Ben Montench. We had Mark Goldenberg.
Mm, good stuff.
Randy Jacobs from Was Not Was.
But like you had had some, you know, pretty big records before that. None? Did you do Runaway?
Yeah, but I mean, that was like only made it to the top 20
radio.
One
of my favorite songs. But I remember your version. It's so good.
Thank you. But at that point, you know, they weren't putting the records in the stores as much. I didn't get a priority. I thought they could have run with that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But Columbia tried to sneak me away because my contract was up, and then Warner's matched it. But that's where they got pissed. They said, well, you know, if you're not going to make a big hit single, you're not worth the money we paid for you.
Yeah.
So.
So, but now it's different, right? It seems like
I have my own label for a reason.
Right, that's your label, Red Wing. Yeah. Oh, that makes so. That I just realized the connection.
Yeah, but you know the John Prine did it first. Oh boy,
yeah,
records,
yeah.
And then Jackson did it.
Yeah, I know. John's guy was that. He's the guy that got reached out to me when I talked to John.
Yeah,
like all that stuff's on his own label. It's why not own your own stuff? Because when you realize after you've gone through this corporate mess that you do have an audience that's going to buy your records. Put them out yourself.
Well, you definitely need to have a team that can, you have to be able to put together a team and afford them that can run the company.
Yeah.
You know, that together they're going to be able to call and, find out about distribution and
so
delivery.
Right, sure.
Keep track. But, when you have
hire the right people.
When you have your own label, they actually pick up the phone.
Right.
Or whatever the equivalent is.
Yeah. But like you're in charge, but you get the right people and then you're sort of overseeing the whole thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Radio play, record stores, everything.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had that run of a few records there where you got a bunch of Grammys.
Yeah.
And it was all very exciting.
Yeah.
And you were sober and you could enjoy the success.
And thank God it happened at 40 instead of 20.
I know.
I mean, on the other hand, look how many people are really handling it. Unbelievable success with so much poise and to get great lawyers, great advice. I mean, Taylor Swift and, amazing.
Have you worked with her? Have you met her?
No, I haven't met her.
Oh.
But, Adele, I mean, people that are huge,
it's
Ed
like beyond...
Sheeran, they're handling it really well. Even Billie Eilish.
Yeah. Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
I know, but
there's not a whole lot of crash and burn going on these days.
I know. What happened?
Yeah. I think we broke the mold.
I guess. What do you know about that? Because I listened to, some of the selected stuff, and I love the fact that you covered that Richard Thompson song.
Because Jimmy of the Day.
Oh my God. Where's that guy coming from?
And he wrote that like Prine and Jackson in his early 20s. I mean,
when he was
on.
With Fairport Convention? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is that on Legion
Leap?
I
left that alone. I think so. I left it alone for like 25 years because Linda did such a killer job of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, have you worked with him? Because
we toured together a lot.
Because like that guy, like I interviewed him once, and he's kind of a wizard. And
that's a good word for him. I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly the way to describe it.
Yeah, yeah. And like I remember, I was doing a gig in Ireland at the Vicar Street at Vicar Street.
I've played there lots.
Sure. And he was there the night before me, and I got in the day before all jet lagged and shit. And the guy who runs the place, he's like, "You want to come see Rich?" I'm like, "Yeah, just interviewed him." So I was able to go backstage and watch him do whatever the hell he does with a guitar.
Unreal.
What is that?
I know. He's completely his own zip code.
Yeah.
And he's got a great memoir.
Yeah.
Just came out. Yeah. Hyatt's is really good too, but Richard's is really wonderful. It's mostly of the early days of Fairport and all that.
I got to read that Joe Boyd one.
Oh, I didn't even know that was out.
Well, no, it's been out for years.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, like about that crew, Nick Drake and Pink Floyd.
String band.
Yeah. What are those guys? What were they up to?
I know.
Did you remember those first couple records?
I do. Yes, I do.
It was like, how many instruments are involved? Are they all playing at the same time?
Exactly.
It was crazy. So, how do you feel about the records that came, after that? Like, what was happening after?
Luck of the Draw?
Yeah.
Nick and Longing in Their Hearts?
Well, yeah.
And then I was really proud to do this two-hour movie that, I partnered with Capitol on.
Yeah.
Road-tested with Kim Wilson and Brian Adams and... who else was
What was
there?
That? Kim Wilson on harp? I haven't seen him in a long time, man. I always thought he was one of the best.
Oh, he's killer. He's still got the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Right.
Yeah, still touring. So I did a live two-hour movie, double CD. Took a little break for the first time since that whole Nick of Time thing.
Yeah.
I was on the road for the full Magilla even before the Grammy nomination, and it was just nonstop.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, all these other places around the world were interested in having me come and play. So I meant something ticket-wise so I could afford to bring my band. So I took a break and then decided after four records with Don and Ed to work with Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake. So I did some albums with them.
Yeah.
And then I started producing myself in the next decade. And it's always the same cycle where you prepare to make the record, you make the record, prep it to be book the tour. That's about a year and a half process, and then 2 years to tour, and then you get a break, and then you make another one. So it's like a 6-year cycle.
But this is, it seems to be the first record, this one, just like that, that you are the sole producer.
No, I did the last couple.
The last couple like that?
Yeah.
And how'd you choose, like, what's your process of choosing? Because, I mean, on, you did a cover of Right Down the Line.
Yeah, Jerry Rafferty as a reggae song.
Yeah, and it's like, how do you choose your covers? Like, I mean.
That's just what I do. I mean, I may not be an original songwriter that's really prolific, but what I'm really proud of is finding chestnut songs and rearranging them, like I did with Runaway.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a shtick that I have. I just love cover songs.
So yeah.
I've done Burning Down the House. I did INXS's Need You Tonight on the last record. And, you know. I did a T-Birds tune on the live record with
Which
Kim.
One? Oh.
I Believe I'm in Love with You.
That's the one with the break?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe I'm in love with you.
Bam, 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 bam.
Hey, man, Mark, you're happening. Have you had the Blasters in here?
Yeah, I talked to Dave. Well, I mean, but you were a little late. Those guys are after you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but I was still living in L.A. Remember Madam Wong's?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. No, but I love that whole rockabilly, you know, Rock Pile, the Blasters. I love that whole retro Ray Campy. I love the Palomino. I love the music. What was the music connection? No.
I don't
know.
The
one in the Valley.
I don't know.
Oh, man, that was so good.
But like Los Lobos, like I talked to Hidalgo, and I think that band is like the most underrated band ever.
Absolutely.
I mean, and now they're sort of like, it seems like they're like, fuck it. You know,
oh, but
almost.
They're doing all kinds of cool little
they
one-offs.
Always do, yeah.
Every record, they mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, it's all, yeah. But they're
they
so...
They did a great version of the Beach Boys' Sail on Sailor.
On the new one.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did all California numbers.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And but, like, they're such a tight band.
Oh, they're incredible. Steve Berlin, holy Toledo.
And you work with
him. I did it. One of my favorite tracks I've ever cut is on a record. I worked with Mitchell and Chad because of Kiko.
Yeah.
And we did a few records together, and... I love the sonics of it. I wanted to mix it up after I did those records for Nick of Time, that whole run.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, there's a song that David sent me called Cure for Love that I did on that 97.
No, I listened to that. Did he play bass on it or something, or no?
No, he played the guitar.
Okay.
Yeah, killer. Oh.
Yeah, he's such a sweet
he is, yeah.
like presence and voice.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Are you going to tour? What are you going to do?
Well, we start production rehearsals tomorrow.
Really?
And then I'm doing Ellen, Kimmel, and Kelly Clarkson 3 days in a row. And then we start in Rochester, like two days later. Yeah, Rochester. Remember that? we have an eight-month tour coming up from the U.S. And then next year we'll go to Australia and play Byron Bay and go to Europe and...
Oh, it's big,
do
man.
All the, yeah, we usually do a two-year tour. We just had to postpone it because of this pesky little pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're lucky you didn't get it.
Yeah, we're in a bubble like a basketball team.
Right. So
I mean, this is testing.
Yeah.
Most action in our nose since the 70s.
Yeah. So you're going to do Kimmel, and you're going to do Ellen, and you're going to talk about this record.
And Kelly Clarkson, too. And
Clarkson's
Good Morning America, and... All kinds
of
stuff.
You
know, I've been doing press for 5 weeks now, so it's like, you know, I'm doing, in there talking to Norway. And,
yeah. Oh, really?
You know, every hour is a different accent. I have a song about recovery on this record that I wrote called Waiting for You to Blow.
Waiting for You to Blow.
And the guy in Germany is going, I don't understand what you mean. He's like reading the lyrics to me.
Riding Shotgun, right? Riding Shotgun, Waiting for You to Blow.
It's all about the little devil going, come on.
Yeah, I love that song.
Thanks.
Like, I knew it, like, because I can never tell, like, is this about some bad relationship she's in?
No,
or
it's
is
about
it you.
It's about, you know, waiting for you. There's a little devil on your shoulder going, come on, stay up an extra 3 hours.
The
Have
relationship
another
with
piece
that
of
guy.
Cake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, why don't you just lie about why you didn't return those emails? You know?
Yeah. Collect a bunch of secrets and resentments.
Exactly.
Push to the limit. Yeah,
expectations or resentments waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah. The one I don't like is you're only as sick as your secrets.
Yeah.
Yes.
I hate to say it, but that's probably pretty true.
Yeah, it's a rough one. You know what I mean?
People are always saying, so how long have you been recovered?
Yeah.
Like, as if it's finished.
No, I know. I was reading the press on this, and it basically says she recovered from, and I'm like, nah, you never recover. You just keep going. Day to day.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this. I wrote a song called Feeling of Falling. I miss that feeling of falling
well, I know,
over
I
the
to
edge.
That. Yeah.
And then this one, Waiting for You to Blow, is just like that, you know, the last the last line is, you know, it looks funny. The lyrics are sardonic, but like Moe's and Randy and John Hiatt, they can write those serious topics.
Right.
You know, but you know, I let her draw love close enough to see she really cares, but no way did they get inside in case there's no one there.
Oof, yeah. So, well, it seems that feeling of falling is a nostalgic thing, you know.
Yeah.
This one is like I need a meeting.
Exactly. I'm just waiting for you to blow. Come on, come on, babe.
Make some phone calls. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Well, all right. So you're going to tour with this band, these guys? That's all.
The different guitar player, a guy from Boston named Duke Levine, and my old longtime guitar player George Marinelli, who kind of wanted to take a break from the road after 50 years. I don't know why, but he's going to come out and be for like 3 weeks here, 3 weeks there. But basically, same rhythm section I've had for decades and decades. Ricky Fitar, one of the greatest drummers ever.
Yeah.
And Hutch Hutchinson, my bass player since 1983, is brilliant.
Now, let's do just
a quick... And a new keyboard player, again, Glenn Patcha.
On the record?
Yeah.
That guy's great on
he
that B3,
great,
right?
Isn't he? Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you know, it's you know, when you hear that sound, you don't expect something new to be happening with it, but he kind of does some...
I agree. He's very... He was with Amy Helm in a band called Ola Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roseanne, he plays with Roseanne Cash and Ry Cooter. He did that Johnny Cash tribute tour that Rye and Roseanne did.
I'm trying to get Rye in here.
Oh,
but he doesn't want. He don't want to leave. He doesn't want to go anywhere.
You should go over there.
I would. I don't know if he's afraid of COVID or if he's, you know, just doesn't do it.
Yeah, I don't know. But what
do you
have
talk
you
to
read
him?
His books?
No.
Oh, he's like written all these wonderful books. Not a lot of
what
books.
What are they about? What?
You know, stories, he's back, this whole backstory about this lefty, you know, it's like a little cat.
No.
There's like some
so they're
interesting
fiction.
Kind of. They're fiction, but historical fiction.
Oh, interesting.
But
yeah, because like, you know, he's...
Tongue-in-cheek, too.
I have no sense of that guy.
He doesn't care about promoting himself.
Hmm. What do you think that's about? Is he bitter?
I just think he's done. I'm not done done making music, but the
But
music,
done with trying to sell it.
The music business. I think he's never been into that.
I just feel like he deserves I don't know if I'm the guy to do it, but like a kind of life.
I agree.
I'm
getting a Lifetime Achievement Award in a couple of weeks at the Grammys. And they should give, I mean, Ry Cooter's the greatest guitar player that I've heard in this lifetime.
Do you remember him from back in the day?
Yeah. But I mean, I didn't hear about him until his first album.
But not like but with Beefheart or anything?
No, that was after that even.
Ah.
So, you know, he was, he played in Taj's first band, The Rising Suns.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, you know, his first album, and he played all over Randy's album and Van Dyke Parks. Have you had him in there?
No.
He's a fantastic interview.
I got to get up to speed on him. I seem to have missed the Van Dyke Parks.
God,
what do I got to do?
Well, try to find some YouTube on him, and you'll fall down that
Which
rabbit
record
hole.
Is it?
Well, I just think that Discovering America or Coming to America, not Coming to America, that's an Eddie Murphy movie, but Discovering America, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's the one?
Well, they're all great. He's so song cycle.
Song cycle, right. Yeah, there are certain people I miss or I don't quite wrap my head
around.
Well,
you're a little bit younger and you didn't grow up in California, so.
That's right. But I know that people love him and I know that he's seen it all and, you know, he's done it all.
Were you in bands when you were a teenager?
No, that's the thing. Like, you know, I never had the confidence and I was never a complete nerd. Like, I never learned songs. Like, I learned how to play. Like, I can play blues and country. I can do a thing. And I've been trying to, I play out a bit now. I finally, at this age... Like, Vivino will play with me.
Nice.
Now.
I love Jimmy.
Yeah, after years of showing me licks when I do Conan, you know, I put together these two guys, and I play at Largo and do comedy.
Great.
But, like, and I told Vivino I was doing it, and he's like, I'll play with you. And I'm like, what?
Oh, that's great.
So he's kind of in the band. So it's like, but this time we're going to do it on April 6th, and he's out of town. And he said, you're ready. Just go do a trio. I'm like, oh, my God.
That'll be great.
Well, I got to figure out songs that I can do that.
Oh, yeah. That'll be great.
I'm trying to work out that John Lee Hooker tune, Little Wheel. Some of them do just weird little things with their guitar that it's not easy to figure out.
Yeah.
What was it like with him?
Fantastic. I mean, we've known each other since 69, so by the time we did that duet together, you know, that was just such a great record.
It was a good record, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but he and I were on a lot of blues festivals together, but when we won that Grammy for the best blues duet... you know, we did tons of press and tons of specials that are now just available on YouTube now. There's like a tribute to his to him with Roy Cooter and Robert Cray, and there's a whole bunch of us at Madison Square Garden.
It's so wild because, like, he's one of those guys where you just got to follow him.
Yeah. Well, a lot of Delta players, they don't go to the four at 12. You know, it's not a 12-bar blues.
It's spontaneous.
It's more jazz, kind of just listen and follow.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to that. You know, I love that Hooker and Heat record because of the talking. The talking on that record is hilarious. You must listen to all my records.
That footage of him on that American Folk Blues
thing. It's amazing.
It's staggering is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's devastating.
It is devastating. That's the thing.
I don't even know why.
I don't think there's anything that you and I are going to do on this earth, this lifetime, that's going to, someone's going to say that was devastating.
No.
I hope not anyway. Because it'll mean the worst thing.
That's right. So wait, before you go, so you're just playing the Strat? How many guitars you travel
with?
I have a
purple cutaway custom metal National that Larry Pagrabo made for me, and he makes guitar for Jackson and Keb Moe and some other people.
So it's like a resonating guitar?
It's like a resonator, but a cutaway and a longer neck, so I can put the capo on 5 frets and get the octave. So I need a longer neck.
Yeah.
And it's got a couple of cool pickups in it. So you can make it acoustic or electric. It'll mix the two.
Oh,
but with the resonator.
Yeah.
And then I always play at Guild F50. So I have a couple of those. One open tuning, one regular tuning.
Yeah.
And then I have 3 Strats. 2 are the signature Fender models. They put my name on them so I could raise money for Boys and Girls Clubs guitar programs.
Oh, yeah.
So I started a guitar program in 200 clubs around the country.
Well, that's great. That's like Wayne Kramer, the guitar, the jailhouse, Kramer gets guitars into jails. And
nice. So I have the Stratocasters, and each one is tuned like a half step down from the other, so I don't have to waste time on stage. Retuning.
Right. Yeah.
So I got the Guilds, the Strats, and I got a great, beautiful L-75 Gibson 1956.
That's an acoustic?
Electric. L-75. Jazz guitar.
With a sharp cutaway?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I know that guitar.
It's beautiful.
Oh, that's
you know
great.
Your stuff.
I'm not too much of a nerd. I can kind of picture certain things. And also, what about the last song on this new record? What was that involved with?
Down the Hall?
Yeah. What's the story on that? It looks
like
there's a backstory.
Well, like the title song, they're both third-person stories about things that I saw in the world that just moved me so much I had to write a song about it.
Yeah.
There was a New York Times Sunday Magazine article in May 18th, 2000. Is it 2018?
Maybe. Yeah.
And it was about a prison hospice program in Vacaville, California.
Yeah.
Beautiful essay, interviews, gorgeous photographs about these prisoners that volunteer to be on the hospice ward and be with people when they pass away.
Yeah.
And I just was so incredibly moved by the story that I wanted to write a song, and I just made up a character, and as if, you know, he was just out of the compassion in his heart, you know, he's in there and he's all bittered and broken up, and you imagine what it's like to go as intimidated as you are by all the strata of prison tribal segregation, like, don't go over there, God, don't mess with that guy.
Yeah.
And then at the end of their lives, they're all the same on this hospice ward, and that's what the song's about, is redemption. Oh, wow.
I tell you, you know, those two songs on this record, you know, I mean, the whole record's good, but like, just like that, and then that last one, the walk, what is it,
Down the Hall.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's very, like, your songwriting capacity emotionally is grown so much.
Thank you.
I mean, losing John, you know, like that, and, you know, it feels like they're almost like I don't know, you know, what you gleaned from him, but, you know,
Singing Angel from Every Night, and just
this
how
is that
much
kind of, these
how
are that
much
kind of songs.
And that's what, you know, I had already knew that I was going to make a story song in a finger-picking style even before COVID and before John passed away, but I wrote the lyrics in 2019, but I put the music on it right before the recording last summer, and I had John in my heart the whole time.
Yeah, I could feel it. Great talking to you.
Mark, it was a pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan.
That is it. She tuned my guitar for me, and I'm going to play it for you. The new album is Just Like That. Get it wherever you get music. She's out on tour. You can go to BonnieRaitt.com. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to see where I'm going to be playing. Now, I'm not a slide player, but she tuned the guitar. So here I'm going to play it. And Derek Trucks gave me this slide. So maybe just by virtue of those two things, it'll sound like something.
Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.